Welcome to the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio. From creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets, here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. This is episode 240. I am currently sitting in my office here in Southern California. That's right, it's me. It's Vincent Diamante just hanging out with the trio here. Who is here? We got Alex May over there on the other side of the world. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good, thanks. It's about -3 Celsius, which is 3 degrees below the freezing temperature of water, for your information. Here in Stockholm, enjoying a rather chilly start to spring. And it is, as we record this, it is Friday night. I'm pretty tired. I've been working pretty hard, solidly on music for the past few weeks, which is a wonderfully tiring but precious luxury for me, because normally I'm having to juggle a whole lot of, you know, business stuff and producery kind of stuff and design stuff together with trying to pretend that I'm actually a musician. Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. How about you, Vince? How are you?
I'm doing great. Let's see. I am coming to the realization that there's so much that I can do with my studio right now, because this feels like a good downtime point for me. So I'm in the middle of dismantling my box, as well as cleaning up my bedroom, which I've been using as my home studio space, and hoping to really, really refurbish this space over the next few months. You know, give it a good thorough cleaning, do the wiring stuff that I've been meaning to do and putting off for the last few weeks. A little bit of downtime for me personally, as well as infrastructurally. This is not really the place that I'm going to get real music composition or production stuff done. But I am working a little bit from a laptop, so I'm just doing a little bit of coding here and there. I can do that anywhere these days.
I'm always a bit envious of coders, because, you know, all they need is their computer, like a keyboard and a screen and a CPU, and yeah, off they go. Whereas for us, our work can't be so portable, can it?
Yeah. I mean, speaking of, Mike, you actually used to do some coding work as well as your music work. Do you feel nostalgic for those times when you could just do your stuff on a laptop?
I do, though most of my work was done on a Silicon Graphics workstation, if you remember those. Using the Irix flavor of Unix and its esoteric audio APIs. So I didn't get the full advantage of the portable lifestyle that I think today's very powerful laptops offers. But there is something to be said for a right brain, left brain balance and the backing back and forth between coding and music that I might feel some nostalgia for.
Mm. Are you... Do you feel any nostalgia for Emacs or Vim?
I was team Emacs, so take your VI, you know, filth elsewhere.
Mike, but, do you know what Emacs actually stands for? Shall I tell you?
I used to, but I don't remember.
It stands for Escape Meta Alt Control Shift. Ha!
Is that really?
No, not really.
I think
really.
Alex is making fun of the very esoteric command.
No,
Emacs was infamous for having really obscure and complex key sequences to do things.
Yeah.
Weirdly, I still have built into my muscle memory the commands to move the cursor up and down and left and right in Emacs, which I couldn't tell you what they are, but my fingers could do it if I sat down at a keyboard.
All I remember is Control X, Control W is save. Anyway, for this isn't at all related to game audio, but for anybody who's wondering what the H we are talking about, there's an age-old rivalry in the programmer's world between these two legacy, iconic, early text editors, one called Emacs and the other called Vi, and then later on Vim. The old-school programmers, This is before the days of, you know, integrated development environments and all-in-one coding packages. These were just text editors, like plain old simple text editors, but not at all simple. Not at all simple or plain. In fact, incredibly fully featured, massive amount of functionality, but also, you know, obviously UX designed for people who you would imagine would spend all day using a text editor. So anyway, that's so Vince, no, Emacs doesn't stand for Escape Meta Alt Control Shift. That's just the Vim users. The Vim users are always teasing Emacs users for their very convoluted keyboard shortcut sequences where you've got to do all this like Control Shift Escape Meta Alt. And that's the joke. So yes, sorry.
That is a pretty great joke though. But you had me
had you for a moment.
I can forge us a path back to game audio by the following associational snippet. Is that, and Alex, you will appreciate this. My first encounter with Emacs was in the packaged version that came with the Amiga computer.
Ah. Oh.
Excellent.
Which, of course, as we know, is a seminal platform for electronic music development.
Oh, yeah.
And we're back into game audio.
Honestly, that's great.
That's weird because a Vim was actually born on the Amiga. Did you know that?
I did not.
Oh.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
This is... We are going way, way off trajectory here.
No.
We should bring it back to game audio.
Yeah, we can do that. I was going to say, trackers, Amiga, that's actually really cool because last week was GDC. And even though I did not have a pass to go into GDC proper, I did spend a day just hanging out around Moscone Center. And I bumped into a number of people, including people that I knew first in the 90s as trackers. It was actually really fun just shooting the breeze with those dudes that I first met as just handles on an IRC channel back in the mid to late 1990s. And... these guys who were doing Pro Tracker stuff and then eventually Scream Tracker, Fast Tracker. But we had a lot of fun just sort of hanging out, talking about, you know, that history that we lived through in different ways, some in person, some just online, because the American demo scene was not nearly as developed or as social as the demo scene in, say, Scandinavia in the late 90s.
Or weirdly, and I still to this day don't understand why, or Australia. Australia also has something about, maybe it's some connection to Australia. Like, you know how in Australia we love Eurovision. So much so that actually the Australians kept on nagging the Eurovision Association to let Australia participate in Eurovision because we love it so much. And then now it's the thing that has everybody always scratching their head is like, why is Australia here? Maybe it's the same with the demo scene as well, because the demo scene and the Commodore Amiga was just huge. But, you know, don't get me started. Regular listeners will, of course, know that I cut my teeth in as a tracker, and still use a tracker to this day. Yes, it's true. So don't get me started. I will not stop. So I'm going to restrain myself. Let's talk GDC, shall we? And leave Commodore aside, otherwise Alex will not stop.
GDC was, I think, pretty cool, even though I didn't actually experience GDC itself. I never set foot inside the Moscone Center. I just hung out basically in the Yerba Buena Park and said, hey, I'm around. And a few people reached out to me on Twitter DMs. Before that, I just bumped into people who were in the line, which had grown to about an hour and a half long around 10 or 11 o'clock on Wednesday morning to get in to the building. And just saying, hey, yeah, what's up? How are you doing? It was actually pretty nice. I had actually not originally planned on being up there in Northern California at all, but a couple of other events and some friends had convinced me to actually just get up there for the day it was really legitimately fun to hang out there for just 24 hours before making my way back down to SoCal. Alex, I know you weren't there, but Mike, you actually were there for the whole week, right?
I was there for half the week. I do not generally attend the summits, which I think are broad domain-focused lecture series. Some of them are for beginners. Some are just focused on particular topics. I usually show up on Wednesday and do the kind of main GDC experience Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, which was the case this year.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah, the summits are always... Well, the summits are pretty fun. The summits are pretty fun. In the past, I would actually go to the summits because I do a lot of stuff for mobile game developers, and they typically have a summit on Monday or Tuesday. And audio tends to have their own thing, which runs on Tuesday. I'm not sure if that was the case this year. I guess not.
I don't remember. I haven't tracked the summits for a long time. I seem to remember that there used to be a kind of a boot camp type audio experience on Monday and Tuesday. And
oh, right.
For our listeners who are thinking about GDC, I would be hard pressed to recommend that versus Game SoundCon in the fall. I think the two are, from what I remember of both, are comparable.
Right, yeah. Game SoundCon is pretty great. I do really enjoy that experience, and maybe we could talk about that a little bit later. But how was your GDC experience?
It was really great. It's for me, it's always a combination of meeting with clients and reconnecting to people I haven't seen in person for a long time. This being my first GDC in a couple of years, this was a major part of the trip. You know, there are people who I hadn't seen since the olden times before the pandemic. So that was great. And going to the seminars, some audio seminars, some general game developer seminars. I usually indulge myself with a couple of talks that are nostalgia pandering, game history, and going to the Experimental Game Expo, which is what I think it's called. That's usually on Friday. This year, I had so many meetings, I couldn't make the self-indulgent presentations. And I was really sad about that. But, you know, we must go where the dictates of business lead us, so I had to be responsible. One presentation I saw that really excited me was a sneak preview given by Austin Wintory on an upcoming game called Stray Gods. And what's cool about this game is that it builds itself as an interactive musical. And I won't go into too much detail about what that means because Austin has said he will come onto the show to talk about this game at length a little bit closer to the release date. So we will hear from him maybe early summer. But the big picture description is if you think of a game like Dragon Age or Skyrim or any kind of RPG that has a dialogue tree where you're going back and forth in dialogue exchanges, and depending on what dialogue option you select, the remainder of the interaction and indeed the future of the world might change. So imagine that, but instead of having these little text exchanges, you have sections of a song, like a musical theater type song, which you present and are then prompted to go in one of several possible directions. So you have this evolving musical which substitutes for the traditional dialogue tree. Is that description at all clear?
Yes. Well, it is clear to me because I had actually seen some of Austin's posts about this on Twitter, as well as the graphical representation of the branching of the music. And I thought this looks very, very cool. So I'm glad that you got a chance to check that out. That seems really, that seems like it would have been a really fun event to attend.
It definitely seems like an interesting and innovative game. I can't speak as to the experience of gameplay, but I certainly want to hear more about it. So we have that to look forward to. For the rest of GDC, I think it was a fairly typical year, or perhaps the first typical year for me since pre-pandemic times, and it was good to be just part of that scene again and to see the bustle of the game community and fellow composers and audio people all thrown into that giant fishbowl of the Moscone Center.
Yeah. Oh gosh, I'm looking at Stray Gods and just realizing game development in countries that are not America seems so interesting and fun. I guess the whole idea of games being either subsidized in full or in part by governmental initiatives. So in the case of Stray Gods, I see the first thing that actually comes up is this project page for the Australian Victorian Music Development Office. And there have been other games that have been put out to market with some help from the Australian government. I think more recently, Untitled Goose Game had such a relationship there. So I look at these things and think, wow, cool, fun, and interesting stuff with a little bit of help from a source that us in America wouldn't normally rely on.
Yeah, it's true, actually. The Victorian government is quite active with funding game projects. And also where I'm from, South Australia, the South Australian government also funds projects fairly aggressively, especially where it involves the creation of local jobs. So if you're able to prove to the government that your project will provide, you know, a certain amount of jobs for local talent for a certain amount of a certain period, then they will actually refund you a fairly sizable percentage of your development budget, which is amazing. So basically you can count on, you know, your development budget being, I don't know the exact figures, but like 70 or 80% of actually, you know, what it costs to make your game. You will get, you know, you will get that back from the government. That is, you get back 20 or 30%. I think I don't remember the exact numbers, but the criteria is, of course, that you need to be creating jobs actually in the state. And that in this day and age can be quite complicated, especially in a place like Australia, where they suffer from a problem of sort of talent just leaving. You know, myself being one example of that. But basically, you know, when you graduate, if you study that in Australia, if you study game development in Australia, and then when you leave university, there aren't very many options for really, really large company, or there didn't used to be very many options for joining larger companies, which means your options are to, you know, roll the dice and go at it as a small indie team. And some of those small indie teams are fortunate enough to get some momentum to become slightly larger small indie teams. And it's at that point where you're often eligible for applying for these kinds of government grants. So it's a very common and, yeah, excellent way to stimulate the industry. And of course, Australia is not alone in doing that in that way. Most of the larger economies in Europe also have similar systems as well. However, I do know that in quite a few cases in Europe, you also need to show that your game has some kind of cultural significance to the culture of the country. So in some countries here, as far as I know, you know, if you're making a game that has nothing to do with the country that you're making it in and doesn't have any contribution to the sharing of that country's culture through the art form of a video game, you know, your chances of being successful in winning those grants are perhaps less high. But yeah, every country is different. But yeah, as you said, Vince, you know, it's a big thing. I didn't know actually that the United States doesn't have a similar kind of program.
It's something that I've heard a lot of developers bemoaning, and often what they'll do is they'll actually diversify their team and say, "Hey, we're actually have a team that has a lot of say people in Scotland that are actually working on this. And even though we're an American company, maybe we can actually find ourselves, because of our team composition, actually eligible for certain grants or whatever." We're kind of going a little bit afield here. It's really interesting to see Austin talk about this project And there were certainly a lot of other musicians that were in the audience posting pictures from this GDC lecture and saying, yeah, I'm excited about this. Were there actually a lot of audio examples on there during the event, Mike?
There was a good number. He traced, if I remember correctly, he would trace a particular interaction and show how the song that was the basis of the dialogue would evolve or change depending on the emotional tenor of your response. And he showed some of the variations and how the same basic idea might be conveyed differently or through different instrumentation to demonstrate a different mood. There was quite a bit of fleshing out the general idea with some examples.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. I'm actually really looking forward to hearing some of that. It seems like there will be a chance to check out some of this online, because on Austin's Twitter feed, he actually retweeted that the development studio is going to be doing an event on Twitch on April 12th. So this podcast episode should be coming to you about a week before, so you have plenty of time to check this out. This Twitch event will be happening on April 12th, if you're in America, or April 13th, if you're in Asia or Oceania or wherever. So there will be a chance to check this out. There's going to be live performances of this interactive game, as well as a Q&A with the cast and developer. So that will be really cool to check it out. Besides this, were there any other lectures or things that you attended that really struck you?
There were several that were very useful in a practical way. There was a series of kind of audio business lectures that I really like. There were a few that I just attended because, you know, I was there and I had a free time slot, so I would go to see developers talk about a mental health game that I thought was just really interesting. A lot of little bits and bobs of random things that I attended just in the name of getting different types of experience. It was a solid year. There wasn't a tremendous amount, perhaps other than Stray Gods, that struck me as, you know, revolutionary or super interesting. But it's I find it always valuable to attend the conference.
Mm, yeah, that's cool. And you mentioned not going to any of those classic game postmortems, huh? That's too bad.
Oh man, I forgot the one that I was really looking forward to. I think it was like a discussion of Laserdisc games or something like that. But I was gunning for it, but I just couldn't make it logistically, and I was really sad. Hopefully it will be included in the GDC vault, so maybe I'll be able to catch it post facto.
Yeah, that sounds cool. There's a Paperboy classic game postmortem that apparently happened. So, darn it. I definitely spent a lot of time with that game, both in arcades as well as on the NES back in the day.
Wow, Paperboy. I remember that.
One of my favorite of those postmortems was, I think, from like 3 years ago, where the developer of the arcade game Robotron came to talk about that. And I think at one point he said that in order to generate randomness, he actually used the game's code itself as like a source of random numbers, if I'm remembering correctly. So, yeah, those things are tremendous. For our listeners, if you can make it to GDC, well, first of all, if you are a composer, if you're an audio developer, if you're a sound designer in the game industry, GDC is almost always worthwhile for the immersion in the community and the networking opportunities. But atop that, the presentations can be really both fun and educational and can give you some insight into what your peers are doing. So I think it's definitely a thumbs up for me anyway, for anyone considering going.
Yeah, I agree. Although I feel like it's maybe 50-50 just how much value I get out of GDC itself, as well as, you know, outside of GDC, whether it be at these parties that are actually set up by these various companies, you know, things like, you know, things like Wyze or FMod or Dolby or Gang, which is technically not part of GDC, but they always seem to have something that's on the GDC schedule. There's a lot of interesting opportunities that come up there just in terms of networking and camaraderie and just, a lot of fun things there. And sometimes it will be even the type of technical or behind the scenes look at how things actually work that you might have originally expected to get out of a GDC proper session, but it comes out in, you know, just over a series of drinks at a bar a couple blocks away.
One approach you could take to GDC is to simply go and either just go there for the parties and social opportunities, or maybe get an expo pass, which is very inexpensive, and then subscribe to the GDC vault and be able to see lectures, see any of the recorded lectures at your leisure over the months to follow. And one advantage to that approach is you could conceivably see all the lecture content rather than whatever happens to mesh with your schedule, and you can see it at your leisure. And it might be cost-effective relative to the price of the most expensive passes. So that is kind of an alt-GDC approach that might preserve the best of most worlds and be less expensive than going whole hog.
That is actually exactly what I was going to say. So there you go. That was that is the way, I think, at least the way to take in GDC. I mean, I guess it depends really on your main objective and where you are in your career. I think when you get to, for example, Vince's level of experience in the industry, you can do this kind of anti-GDC GDC, which is where you're just there. And after you cross a certain threshold of experience, you'll know enough people to be able to get a huge amount of value out of just physically being there. You don't have to go into the Moscone at all. You can just hang around outside it, and parties and lunches and dinners, and you can get a huge amount of value from the networking opportunities from the people that you already know. I guess if you are not based in the area, or you are a little earlier in your career journey, then the way that you describe, Mike, is I think that that's the absolute best way to enjoy GDC, just because, I mean, let's be real here, it is extremely expensive, GDC. And if you're coming from overseas, basically the cost of your ticket is the same cost as what it takes to get through the doors, which is kind of ridiculous, I think, but anyway, that's what it is. And then you factor in, the accommodation, hotel accommodation, as well as the plane ticket and the GDC ticket all together. It's just, it's a lot of money for somebody earlier on in their career. So doing it, as you suggested, where you get the expo pass and you hang around the area during the day and, go to parties and stuff like that. And then having the benefit of being able to access all of the content on the vault later on in the comfort of your own office or studio, and being able to take notes comfortably, or pause or rewind and go back, or pause on a good slide so you can take some notes or stuff like that. I think it's the best way, because if it's about networking, this you get to meet some people that you sit next to in the GDC lectures, or that you're standing in front of somebody in a line and you just strike up a conversation. You can do that, but I think the value you get from just being in the area and going on the expo floor is, as you said, Vince, it's comparable. So it's just really, really, really expensive.
Those costs do add up. And actually, I was thinking about an instance where the actual value of the lecture itself really paled in comparison to what happened immediately after. So, if you haven't been to GDC before, everyone has a pass, but the passes vary in their tiers. Like, some people will have an all-access pass, some people might have an audio-only pass or whatever. So they'll scan your badge at the door and say, you can go into this specific lecture room. Or maybe they'll say, no, actually, your pass is not eligible to get in. Remembering this one lecture that was done by Square Enix and was talking specifically about Final Fantasy 13 and the sound design there. And I thought that it just did not work. It was not a very good lecture because there was just not a lot of good, solid information happening during the lecture. I think it might have been motivated by their desire to present the lecture entirely in English rather than relying on translators that are working in real time while they present in Japanese. And they just did not do a good job of presenting a substantial amount of hard information as to how their system actually worked, which was what ostensibly the lecture was trying to do. On the other hand, after the lecture, they had the opportunity to go to the nearby breakout room. And that breakout room had a fantastic follow-up group discussion about what was really going on in the systems in Final Fantasy XIII that they were trying to describe. In that case, like, there were people that I know were not there for the lecture itself. Maybe they just had an expo pass. Maybe they were not actually able to do the whole audio track at all. But they were able to go to the breakout room where they did not check for specifically the passes, and they were able to hang out while these guys were actually expounding on all their ideas that they were trying to convey in the lecture itself, and they were doing a bang up job there. I think because people that were gathered around were asking some very pointed questions that were getting them to really open up about what was going on in the system. So, you know, sometimes you might be missing out if you're only restricting yourself to just the lecture itself. That follow-up there, that was really powerful and informative.
That's good advice, actually. I didn't know that the expo pass would actually allow you to get into those breakout lecture rooms.
The breakout room is actually just a space where a lot of people can just hang out and relax a bit, as opposed to a lecture room that had any sort of schedule attached to it. So the people would just hang out at these tables, and there would be a bunch of other tables where there might be people that are just relaxing and preparing for a lecture, perhaps. Like sometimes people that are preparing for their next sessions would go there. But they would just let people into there regardless of their passes. They didn't actually check at the door for the breakout post-lecture.
Cool. That's a great GDC hack.
It's also sometimes the case that the breakout room is just the hallway outside the lecture room, or maybe there's some chairs across the lecture room, and it's not even a formal room itself. It's just kind of a gathering of people immediately after the talk. They usually have to clear out the lecture hall because the next one is coming in. So as Vince pointed out, if you've got an expo pass, you can get into the Moscone Center. You can't get into any of the lectures, but you can wander the halls like a poltergeist and see if there's any interesting discussions happening. And you can look at the schedule and say, okay, this lecture ends at 3:00. So at 3:05, I'm going to stand outside and see if the lecture spills out for some Q&A. It's an approach I'd never thought of before that you're pointing out. It seems very clever.
Yeah, it works great. I certainly did that before, back when I was a student in the 2000s. Maybe not quite as pointedly or effectively as I would do now, but I do remember getting some good value there, just hanging out after these lectures, and people would come out, and wow, there would be some interesting discussions. It was definitely a fun and good time there, even with just an expo pass.
That's a great, great GDC hack.
One other aspect of GDC that I thought is worth pointing out, especially for anyone who hasn't gone, are the roundtable discussions, which are moderated discussions by whoever shows up. Sometimes there might be a chief presenter, but on some occasions, it's predominantly a attendee-driven discussion. And those are opportunities for an attendee to connect with peers on a particular topic. So as opposed to free-form networking where you introduce yourself and you hand a business card to someone, there's a slightly more structured but still easygoing discussion opportunity at the roundtables. And I have gotten gigs from discussions at roundtables just by talking to the person sitting next to me or bringing up some topic that was under discussion and then finding somebody afterwards who I thought had made an interesting contribution. So those are also really interesting unadvertised networking opportunities that I advocate for anyone going to GDC.
Those roundtables are great. And it's not just for audio. Like everyone really has a similar feeling when it comes to that. Oh, they find someone that just resonated with them in terms of the topics that they were bringing up. And a friend of mine who was a programmer, not working in games, but was very interested in AI, he went to an AI roundtable and it actually happened just as you described, where another person brought up some similar topics and he was able to expound on them. And then they got together and were able to flesh out an interesting relationship afterward that resulted in hiring at a new game space. So yeah, those roundtables are really great.
You mentioned AI just there, Vince. It's a bit of a hot topic right now, isn't it? I think across pretty much all areas of technology and, you know, bleeding into the sort of cultural and socioeconomic, implications for advanced AI technology and its integration into society in the future. It's quite a discussion point at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Actually, on Twitter a couple days ago, I saw this dude who I guess is an AI person talk about this thing called Wave Tool. And saying, hey, yeah, creators and musicians are going to love this. I always love when they talk about creators. Like, oh, okay, I guess I'm a creator. Sure, whatever. But I look at this thing and think, is this really that interesting? He talks about it being ChatGPT-4 for music and editing. It's the craziest music tool I've seen so far. And, you know, it's that whole pose thing where I'm not sure if he's lauding it or trying to make fun of it. I honestly can't tell, but still, it is pretty interesting. Did any of you two actually see this this Wave Tool video that was making the rounds on Twitter?
Well, I followed the link when you posted it and then followed the rabbit hole a little further and looked at the general page of the company. From what I can see, Wave Tool is a web browser-based DAW, of which there are a couple, and it gives you the basic tools that you'd expect with a GUI and audio processing and maybe a sound set that lends itself towards electronic music. But what was interesting, and what I think was the subject of the meme that you posted, is a plugin or a feature called Conductor. And Conductor is a command line chat with a GPT-4-based AI that allows you to make requests with respect to the production or even the content of your DAW project. And what I saw of this demo video was somebody giving simple requests for generative AI music. So can you write me a funky melody? Can you give me a beat? Can you make that beat quieter? Can you make it more complicated, etc.? And this was all through the command line tool, just like any other ChatGPT style conversation. It was just domain specific, and the AI had access to the DAW and could make changes and could create content and could twiddle the parameters and play with plugins, etc. So that's what I saw, and that I think is maybe less interesting in what it literally offers than in what it points to in the future. Mm-hmm. Across similar tools. What was your take, Vince?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely some interesting possibilities that I feel like are on the horizon. The things that were being presented in that video were a little bit simple, ranging from sort of simple to strange. So, okay, let me type in this long sentence that ultimately ends up with turning down a track 3 dB or something like that. It seemed kind of funny that. And then there was also another thing in the video where he talks about where the person prompts, I've heard about this thing called sidechaining. Can we try that? Or something along those lines. And he decides to make the melody pump with the beat, which was kind of funny to see. But that type of interaction model does make me think about what it could be in the future, where, you know, what if you were talking to some other AI model that's trained many, many generations in the future, and you could say something along the lines of, hey, this sounds a little bit too sibilant. Can you deal with that a little, you know, for me? Or what can we do in order to make this sound a little bit more magical? And there was a little bit of a hint of that when the prompt in the video was talking about making it sound more spacey. And the algorithm responds with, let's mess around with reverb in order to make it sound spacey. And it's like, okay, that's actually kind of cool. That's the closest thing that was presented in that video to something that was interesting to me. And interesting enough to make me think about, okay, what is the future of this? Maybe there is some sort of future there on the horizon. You know, what do you think, Alex?
I think that Mike summed it up perfectly in his response to the video that you posted, actually, on our Game Audio Hour, internal Discord channel. Mike actually wrote, and I quote, he said, "It's easy to imagine what's possible, more tricky to imagine what's useful." And actually, you know, I think that that sentence, for me, sums up a lot of what's going on with this, rapid development of AI technology. It's exciting, it's interesting, it's also scary. It's frightening, but it's also, as Mike said, the imagination just runs wild with thinking about what could be possible. But when it comes down to actually, okay, well, this is amazing technology, but how is it going to be useful to us? That's a much harder question to answer. And, you know, the video itself, I think, demonstrates that very well. It's like, well, that's great. You know, that's an amazing function that you've got going there. But really, yeah, as you said, make it more spacey. Okay, let's experiment with reverb. All right, I'm glad that I had a very advanced artificial intelligence model suggest that for me. Or, you know, the drums are too loud. Let's experiment with turning them down by 3 decibels. Okay, yeah, you know, it's like, that's not very useful, really, when I could just, you know, rather than spending the time typing that out, I could actually just do it myself. I think that in general, as per Mike's comment there about how AI is going to be useful, it's so hard to see, and it's so hard to know at this point, you know, where it's going to lead. I would say that personally, I'm not, you know, obviously our field with generative music and artificial, you know, AI generated music and things like that, you know, hey, ChatGPT, give me the soundtrack for this game. It has to have this, it has to have that, it has to have this, 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 and that, and make it like this and that, you know, and then, like, I don't know, 15 seconds later, here you are, and it delivers you a whole bunch of stems in, you know, 24-bit, 48 kilohertz wave files of, you know, all seamlessly looped and all ready to go and packaged up, ready to put into your game. It's like, well, maybe that's the ultimate goal of the future for all of this, but at the same time, actually, again, per Mike's comment, how useful is that really when fundamentally we're making art here, really, you know? And I don't quite see it the same way that, you know, there's obviously a lot more of a controversial side to artificial intelligence for image generation, and that's been much more publicly visible in the media. You know, artificial intelligence, Midjourney, for example, being able to create, you know, exquisite looking images. Maybe that's the future of where this is going for audio as well, for game audio. But at the same time, I'm not too worried about that, because I think in general, when it comes to things that we do that are intended to have some kind of artistic objective, there always seems to be this weird, you know, we take it so far, and then there's this sort of retrospective looking backwards and a desire to sort of claw back some of that analog human side. And, you know, the perfect example, of course, is recorded music going through analog mediums into digital recorded music, through to streamed music, through to this sort of instant disposable world of music that we have now, where you can literally just, you know, go to any of the streaming services and type in any song of in recorded music's history and just hear it immediately for very low cost, if not totally free. And then, despite that, we've taken it to that ultimate point that now people are sort of clawing back at the, we want something less transient, we want something more significant out of our musical listening experience. And look at that, all of a sudden we've got, you know, vinyl making this massive resurgence, selling more than CDs, which is fantastic and also weird and wonderful. And the same with photography as well. You know, digital photography is so quick, so easy, so high quality, so convenient, so economical compared to film photography at any point in film photography's history. And yet now, you know, of course, people are wanting something. They're wanting more of that sort of unpredictable nature of film photography. And here we are, film photography and mechanical cameras and stuff like that is coming back. The smartwatch versus, you know, the mechanical watch, same thing. So I think that perhaps potentially with AI technology in visual arts and in arts and entertainment, such as in video games, maybe we might see a similar thing where perhaps there will be one day in the future where we can just say, hello, mid audio, please create my soundtrack for me. Here are some cues, here's some requirements, off you go. And then it's all done. Maybe at that point, you know, there'll be a sort of resurgence of like, well, no, actually, I want to get a person to do this, and I want that person to bring to this piece of music their own experience, their own style, their own sensibilities, their own interpretation, their subjective emotional interpretation of these, you know, artistic requirements that our game has. A lot of that is going to be, even if AI gets to the point of being able to do that effectively, the very fact that it is not done by a person, I tend to think that in itself is going to create a desire to have it done by a person, if you know what I mean. In the same way that, you know, all these other advanced technologies that we enjoy and take for granted every day now have created this sort of renaissance of the old ways of doing things, you know. So, yeah, it's fascinating, wonderful, and highly significant new technology, and that's exciting. It's also very frightening. But, yeah, like Mike said, whilst it's easy to imagine what is possible and the imagination can really run wild with all of this, it's also much more difficult to imagine practically how it's going to help us in the future. So sorry, that's an extremely long-winded answer to your question. As you can see, I've done a fair bit of thinking about this. But yeah, that's how I feel.
I think we can also look for a few historical precedents. I'm thinking now of the Unplugged revolution in the early 90s that was a response to the very produced, overproduced sound of pop music in the 80s, where we had gone so far away from what we thought of as human performance that there was suddenly a desire to go back to a dude sitting at a mic with an acoustic guitar. And that really informed at least one branch of what was happening in pop music at that time. So building, Alex, from what you said, if the novelty of AI-generated music turns into a mania or craze and then is overused as mania tools tend to be, we may well see a backlash and a desire to return back to more organic, humanistically generated music. I would not be surprised by either of those.
Yeah, and I think there's a similar analogy with like 3D TV and 3D movies and also VR games and VR entertainment. You know, one might have thought, say, I don't know, around circa 2014, one might have thought that, oh, this is the future of gaming. And in 9 years' time, you know, nobody will be playing games on a flat screen anymore. We're all going to be, you know, playing games in VR because this is the future. Again, it's the exciting aspect of this new technology and the imagination can really run with it. and look what's happened. You know, VR is here to stay. It's not going anywhere, you know, but it's definitely not mainstream, and it definitely will never be mainstream, but it still is a very significant and important genre of gaming. In the same way, you know, I can see that AI, perhaps there will be a time when AI, like, just like we have, say, for example, procedurally generated levels in a game, right? That's exciting. That's fantastic. Wow, look, now you don't need a level designer because you can build code that designs all your levels for you infinitely. Fantastic. And yet here we are, like, procedural generation is nothing new, and we've been doing that in video games, you know, since the 80s. And yet here we are, you know, that the role of a level designer is still highly appreciated and highly sought after, you know, a human level designer. Why would we need a human level designer when we have procedural generation? So potentially, perhaps it could go the same way that, yes, maybe just like there is a place for VR games in games and there is a place for procedural generation in level design, perhaps there will also be a place for, you know, artificially AI-created game audio, but maybe it'll just be a place for it in the same way that procedural generation and VR has their places in their fields as well. And as you said, Mike, yeah, maybe there will be a place for that, and there'll also be a place for people to inject, you know, unpredictability and their own subjective experience and emotion into things as well. What do you think, Vince?
Yeah, certainly the idea of a place for it resonates with me. When I think back to some of the stuff that my friends who were getting into the game industry were doing back in the early mid 2000s, it makes me glad that modern tools for procedural generation actually exist. Like, I had a friend that was working at EA, and his job was literally to place chairs and designate them as places where people could sit. And he would spend weeks at a time just working on that within the larger 3D environment that was being created. And like, okay, that's certainly important, I guess. What did you do after that? And then it became, spending weeks trying to designate places within these environments that people could actually hide or cower behind on this game. And I'm like, okay. Nowadays, those are trivial tools. Certainly, we can do some other things with games, and we can rely on algorithms to figure out some of that stuff rather than us manning that and having to deal with that for weeks or months at a time. So that's cool. But then there's also all those games where the procedural generation was itself the point, and I was very excited about that. All those Lucasfilms games from the 80s, and I'm thinking about things like Rescue on Fractalis, where it was procedurally generated movement around a 3D space. It was procedurally generated 3D landscapes that you had to move around in order to, you know, rescue all these people and fly around, and it was fun to do that. Followed shortly after by Ball Blazer, which is the go-to example for music and procedural generation. Seemingly the only go-to example out there for a procedurally generated jazz soundtrack for video games. I keep on wondering what else is going to come up when it comes to procedurally generated music and games. It's Ball Blazer and then CPU Bach. You know, there you go. Those are your big examples. And then a couple of other things have happened since then, but they're sort of interesting, fun curiosities rather than the entirety of the soundtrack being generated procedurally. There are some fun things out there, and it does make me think that maybe in the future I'll be relying on AI in some way to relieve some of the pressure on some aspect of music creation, composition, production, so that I could focus on something else. And maybe that something else is going to be way more exciting than I can than I can conceive of at this point. I don't know what sort of music I'm going to be writing 5 years, 10 years from now. But maybe, again, I should be thinking on an even smaller scale than that, considering that just this week there was a letter from the, what's it called, that group of hundreds of people, like, you know, all these luminaries and leaders, you know, like your Bill Gates or Elon Musk's, and they're saying, hey, we should pause development of AI for a while so that we can perhaps anticipate what this might mean for beyond games, beyond music, but the nature of human life and how we're going to sustain ourselves as a society. That's kind of fun there to think about. What is AI and the development of it really that much of a threat to the development of us as a society, as a civilization? I haven't actually read that letter, but the headlines have certainly been making their ways through the social media right now. I don't know what to think about that.
Yeah, there's a really famous, at least amongst bass players, there's a famous interview with one of the greatest studio bass players from the 70s and the 80s, Anthony Jackson. And it was filmed either at the end of the 70s or very early 1980s. And somebody asks Anthony Jackson if he is worried about the... Because at that time in the early 80s, MIDI was just arriving on the scene, and it was possible to finally, easily program bass lines out of your, you know, your DX7 or whatever, or your Juno synth, and have these programmed bass lines together with drum machine parts on recordings, right? And of course, that's creating, you know, the synth sound of the 80s that we all know and love. And Anthony Jackson, being a studio-based session player, he was asked whether he was worried about that, you know, in the future, nobody would need bass guitarists anymore because we're all programming synths now, right? Now, it's quite comical when we think about it now, because now, of course, we need bass guitarists. You know, it's ridiculous. Like, a synth is a synth and a bass is a bass. You know, and yes, you can make a synth sound like a bass guitar, but everybody who knows, if you want a certain style of music or you want a certain aesthetic, you get a bassist to play it, or you play it yourself on a real bass guitar, right? I mean, we all know that. Mm-hmm. But in this interview, it's quite funny, actually, because Anthony Jackson, he's really serious, and he says, I don't remember the exact words, but to paraphrase, he says, "You can put me in the grave before I will be defeated and outplayed by a machine. I will never allow a machine to outplay me. If you can make a bass line that I can't play on a bass guitar on your synthesizer, then you can put me in the grave right now." And he says, I'm deadly serious. You know, I will never be outplayed by a machine. I will not let it happen. And now when we look back at that, you know, it seems kind of comical. It's like, wow, hey, dude, chill out. You know, you don't need to be so threatened by this. You know, a synth bass can coexist with a bass guitar. This, you know, this, it seems obvious to us now. But at the time, with all this new technology with, you know, programmable synthesizers in popular music, it was very, very threatening. And even though now, you know, 40 years down the line, there's definitely a place for bass guitars, and there's definitely a place for synth bass as well. So, yeah, I think that our initial reaction has always been with this kind of extremely advanced, future-leaning technology to feel very, very threatened. This is where it relates to art, of course, and art and music, which is what we do. When it comes to other uses for AI technology, especially as it relates to society as a whole, that's somewhat different. And I think that these two discussions are separate. But yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? We always, when it comes to art and AI, we're always, our immediate knee-jerk reaction is to feel threatened, as if, you know, this is it. This is the end of our profession now. It's all being taken over by the robots.
There's an aspect to this video that I thought was interesting, that's a little bit tangential to the artistic philosophical discussion we're having that I thought was worth briefly pointing out. And not so much the part where somebody was typing, hey, write me a melody, and the plugin said, sure, and generated a pretty awful melody, but it's where the person was interacting with the production parameters. And this is where I see some real potential in AI as a alternative interface to the plugins and the tools that we use right now. If you think about a tool like Neutron, there's already some AI aspects to it, right? It's listening to your mix or your instrument track, and it's trying to guess what you want aesthetically, and you give it a few guidelines like, this is a bass line or this is my mix, and it applies some encoded mix engineer knowledge to sculpt your mix. Imagine being able to do that, but with either a voice or chat interface using natural language. So you could say something like, hey, can you switch all the string tracks to a plate reverb so I can hear what that sounds like? That would be a really interesting tool that would obviously save you a tremendous amount of time. It's something we can do now manually, or we could write a script to do that. But a natural language interface that had an abstract representation of the contents of your session could do very broad, sweeping, and often mechanical chores on the engineering level and save you a tremendous amount of time. Another example is, hey, can you generate all the stems for me? I mean, most people know that that's a pain. There's usually, even when there's a stem generation system in your DAW, there's usually a bit of tweaking and muting and unmuting or renaming things that needs to be done. I see AI as a very potentially fruitful abstract interface for those broad sweeping kind of chores that you might, those commands you might give to an engineer or an assistant. So that was the insight that this video gave to me, the little hint about what might happen in the future. And I'm a little excited about that possibility.
Yeah. That sounds good. I think that the some of the more mundane aspects of our work that tends to remove us from the sort of emotional flow of writing music specifically, those kinds of things, if they were assisted by that kind of technology. I'm not exactly sure that like typing it into a command line or even saying it with my voice is the most intuitive manifestation of that kind of functionality. But yeah, the potential for assistance with automating some of those really mundane, non-artistic aspects of what we do, that could be very interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This has been a really great talk about what's possible. Well, what's possible now, as well as what it's inciting in us for what might be the future. I think that future is going to hit sooner rather than later. But before that, we need to probably wrap up this episode, which means jumping right to conspicuous consumption. I actually still need to think about that because I've been so focused on work for the last week. But Mike, surely you've been consuming something interesting and worth spreading out to the world, right?
Well, my consumption took a little bit of a hit during GDC week because a lot of my normal habits were disrupted and I was on the road and I didn't have access to my games. But I have been watching on the TV front season 3 of Picard, and have been pleasantly surprised by the quality of both the production and also the music. I think the original score, the parts of the score that are not reprising like the Next Generation theme, or I think the Deep Space Nine theme, are evocative and organic, and if not overtly thematic, are at least expressive of what's going on. And I think it's a nice combination of good storytelling in a sci-fi genre that we haven't seen in a while, and a little bit of a throwback to older eras of sci-fi scoring. I think that's the most memorable consumption I've done this week. How about you, Alex?
Two things. John Williams' Star Wars Episode II soundtrack. yes. I had the... on the project that I'm working on, I think maybe we've all had it in game audio at some point where the client says, can you make it sound like this? And it's a John Williams soundtrack.
Oh, really? Ooh.
at that point, I usually say, let me call my friend Mike Shapiro. But anyway, No, so that's one thing. And the other thing is Chris Hulsbeck, Turrican 2, the final fight, the main title theme for Turrican 2.
Yes.
The classic, the iconic, legendary classic Amiga tune, Turrican 2 soundtrack. So I think that was my attempt to take John Williams and transpose it into something that maybe I could potentially come close to. I definitely couldn't do John Williams, but I can do Demo Scene. So yes, no, people are there is no real direct correlation between Chris Hulsbeck and John Williams, other than they are both legendary composers in their own right and in their own fields. But yeah, that's those two things that's what I've been consuming.
I actually wonder about that. Like, have you actually checked out the Hulsbeck in concert stuff? Because I think some of his stuff actually does translate quite well to the orchestra.
Yeah, I have actually. It's pretty cool. But, you know, I mean, I think because I grew up with the Amiga, I grew up with trackers, and I still use a tracker. Like, it's the orchestra, to me, when they're playing some of the Turrican music, it's like, yeah, this is good. But, like, come on. Let's be serious now.
Yeah.
You know, there's only one way to listen to this music. You know, it has to be that original crunchy 8-bit, or what's the word my friend used to describe the 8-bit sound of the Amiga? Wet.
Mm.
the sort of wet sound of that crunchy 8-bit sound chip. But yeah, anyway, so what about you, Vince? Have you thought of what you've been conspicuously consuming?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I have been consuming a decent amount of stuff. It's just I haven't really dove deeply into them yet. So I've got the PlayStation VR 2. I think I actually bemoaned the fact, I'm not sure if it was on the show or if it was on Twitter, but Gran Turismo has been really tough for me. Maybe it's just because of all the motion as well as the difficulty of getting that VR headset right on the sweet spot on my head. So if it's not quite perfectly set there and with all the motion, then I get sick really, really quick. On the other hand, games where I am mostly stable, so for example, Tetris Effect Connected, that thing in VR is fantastic. But I've been trying to play some of these other games, so I recently bought this bundle of PlayStation VR 2 games called The Tale of Onogoro and Last Labyrinth. And they're pretty interesting games. I've only checked them out for a little bit, but they're kind of similar from the perspective of, oh, it's you in a 3D space and you're hanging out with this girl who's kind of guiding you along the way, but is sort of restricted in some way. So you have to direct them with your controllers to actually do a specific task. Very different games, very different feeling games. And actually pretty interesting in terms of the audio, because they're characters and they're speaking, especially in the case of Last Labyrinth, they're speaking, or not speaking, but, you know, they don't really understand what's going on. So, like, you really can't understand their language, but you have to sort of direct them all the same. So there's some interesting stuff going on there, both the fact that they are VR games, and we're still very much in the beginning of what is accepted or interesting in terms of VR game design, as well as the audio space that's there, full 3D environments that are in and of themselves pretty interesting spaces to live in or escape from or whatnot. So that's what I've been doing.
Cool.
Very cool.
Yeah. So, wow. With that, we come to the end of episode 240 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, where we also post notices about future episodes, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the Twitterverse. And of course, the easy way to do all of this without having to remember any of what I just said is to go to GameAudioHour.com. So go ahead and do that while I clean up the octave rollers on my iwi. Bye. Yeah, I've got to clean them up because I cannot switch octaves on my iwi. It's those metal rollers are a pain to keep clean.
Is that what they are? They changed the octave to that. I've always wondered that.
Yeah. So I just got to break out the alcohol and the Q-tip, and yeah, there's a little bit of...